Now, the House committee investigating the January 6th attack in the U.S. Capitol is reviewing new documents turned over last week by former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Among them, a PowerPoint presentation that detailed ways former President Trump could have tried to overturn the election results in the lead-up to the protests and riot at the Capitol. We're learning more about the latest findings of the committee investigation and what's at stake. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this and the latest documents that came out from this committee? Do you have questions about what's going on? Is this something that you are concerned about? Do you want to see the committee look at just January 6th itself or wider efforts to overturn the 2020 election results? What do you think is at stake? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again, and it's great to be here again.
I'll ask you the question I just asked our listeners. What do you think is at stake in this ongoing investigation of January 6th and the events leading up to it?
Well, I think the overdramatic answer is to say the stake of American democracy is really, or the stage, or let's say the health of American democracy is at stake. But we don't completely know what's going on, which is partly the whole purpose of the investigation. We know, and I think most of us are willing to say, that what happened on January 6th was not good. I mean, for the first time since what, the 19th century, the U.S. Capitol was occupied. I know some people describe them as patriots, but at the end of the day, this was not good. It was an effort to try to disrupt the counting of the electoral votes. And so part of what the January 6th commission is trying to do is simply figure out what do we know? And there seems to be some evidence, although no one's reaching any conclusions yet, that some of this is tied into the White House. I hate to use the old line from Watergate about what the president knew and when did he know it, but that's what they're trying to find out here. Who was involved in what? Trying to perhaps prevent the peaceful transition of power from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. So I think there's a lot at stake here. And what the commission's trying to find out at the end of the day, what kind of coordination was there? Was the president involved? Was White House staff involved? We don't have all the answers yet in terms of what's going on, but this investigation is trying to get the answers to these questions. And so all of us, I think, should be interested in this investigation and in what it tells us about American democracy and about what? About what presidents and staff are doing.
Before we dig into some of the details, if the January 6th protests had stayed peaceful or not happened at all, people were already concerned that week about the tapes of the president pressuring the Georgia Secretary of State to find enough votes to flip the election. Some of the documents that have come out involve pressure on Vice President Pence to, in effect, unilaterally reject some states' electors. Would this be worth investigating even if the Capitol hadn't been breached on January 6th?
I think it would be also, too. I oftentimes tell my students that the most important election in American history was in 1800. And it was what? When we had the peaceful transition of power from one political party to another, from the Federalists to what became what's called the Democratic Republican Party. And what has been a characteristic of American democracy for what, over 200 years, has been the respect of a losing party to recognizing the legitimacy of the election, and of saying that, listen, the elections were fair and square, we lost fair and square, congratulations to the victor and move on. And that's what's critical to American democracy and to stable democracies across the world. It's the acceptance of fair election returns. And what we're getting here is what? A troubling sign that in the pressure or the efforts by the president to try to pressure the Secretary of State of Georgia is what? Is not a playing by the rules. It is a effort to what? Perhaps maybe subvert the rules. It is concerns when last year the president and his staff were saying that we have widespread election fraud. the extent of which, even though there's no evidence to support that, we had over 60 court cases that adjudicated this question and basically refuted those claims here. Nonetheless, we've got among those who lost the election this feeling that what? That the election was stolen. And that's dangerous for democracy. And so we need to be doing a better job of understanding, again, who said what, who was plotting what the president was saying in terms of Georgia, the pressures putting on them. All this, I think, becomes important for understanding something about how we run our democracy in the United States.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School, looking at the ongoing January 6th investigation. You can call in with your thoughts, your questions, your worries about what might or might not come out of this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, this House committee has talked to a lot of people, a lot of attention on now one of the people not talking to them, Mark Meadows, former White House chief of staff. He supplied some documents that he said didn't fall into protections of executive privilege. First of all, can you talk about what we've seen and heard about those documents that he provided, including that the PowerPoint presentation, not created by Meadows as far as anybody could tell, but raising some concerns?
Well, what we're seeing at this point is actually an outline here, an outline regarding how the White House apparently tried to come up with a scenario of ways that they could essentially subvert the election and throw the Electoral College in their favor, you know, by whether it is, again, pressuring the vice president, pressuring the counting of the electoral votes, by trying to put pressure on particular states. It really outlines a pretty comprehensive, I'm going to call it sort of comprehensive legal strategy or political strategy for trying to overturn the results of the election. Now, some of it is an effort to manipulate the rules. Some of it appears to be, again, on the face of it, outright illegal, but it clearly is giving us the sense of what? Of the fact that there was something far more coordinated leading up to January 6th. And it's possible that what actually happened on January 6th in terms of the demonstrators heading off to the Capitol was part of a fact of a larger strategy that might have been connected to the White House. Again, we don't have all the data, all the facts in at this point, but that's what we're starting to see at this point, that there's something far more significant than what? Just a bunch of angry protesters showing up on January 6th.
And Mark Meadows now joining some others who have said they don't have to testify in front of this House committee, citing in part executive privilege, saying the president gets to talk to his staff or her staff and doesn't have to. They don't have to reveal those confidential conversations. Makes it too hard to be a president if you can't do that. What do you make of that claim in this situation?
Okay, a couple of things. I know a few months ago I was on this show talking a little bit about executive privilege. And even though the Supreme Court has said executive privilege does protect conversations that the president have in order to ensure confidentiality, the Supreme Court has said two different things. First, the executive privilege really only protects the president of the United States. It doesn't go further down the executive branch chain. And this is the case U.S. versus Nixon, when Richard Nixon as president wanted to withhold the White House tapes from being able to be subpoenaed. What the court said is that whatever executive privilege exists, it must give way to the demands to explore and investigate possible criminality in the White House. And I mention all this because Mark Meadows himself cannot claim executive privilege. He's out of office. The president's out of office. They can't claim executive privilege because they're no longer presidents, or no longer in office. But even if they could, the demands of exploring possible criminality outweigh any executive privilege that exists. That is under current Supreme Court doctrine and current interpretation of executive privilege under the U.S. Constitution. So their arguments, I think, basically again, under current framework of law, are not valid.
But this is a House committee, not a legal investigation. It's not the Justice Department or a prosecutor. Given that, can they say we're investigating possible wrongdoing, even though we can't actually charge anybody with anything?
Yes, I think you can, because here we still have what? Exploration of criminality. We have powers that Congress has in terms of being able to do oversight into the executive branch. Remember also with Watergate, you had simultaneously a special prosecutor operating at the same time that the House Judiciary Committee was operating in terms of doing investigations, and the president was eventually compelled to also turn those tapes over to Congress. And so the parallels, I think, are strong enough between, let us say, the Nixon case and some subsequent decisions that came afterwards and what's happening here, that for all of us who learned at some point the principles of what? Separation of powers and checks and balances. This is the checks and balances aspect of that equation, of Congress's legitimate authority to be able to hold the executive branch accountable and to, again, ensure that it was not engaged in criminal activity. So I think we basically have the same principles going on here.
We're talking about the January 6th investigation in the U.S. House with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Based on what we saw about a year ago, are you worried about the future of elections in the United States? Do you want to see new safeguards in place? What do you want to see come out of this U.S. House investigation, or do you want it to be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Hamline University political science professor David Schultz, learning about the latest findings of the January 6th commission in the U.S. House, what it means for the ongoing investigation. You can join in with your comments, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the lead up to January 6th? What do you hope that this House commission gets to, or committee, I should say, gets to? Do you think it's time to wrap up the investigation? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. First of all, I think it's ironic that a man, Donald Trump, who once said that anyone who takes the fifth is guilty, then that's kind of like executive privilege. But I think common sense tells us, even if this committee, you know, it gets so little cooperation from the Republican Party and the former president and his allies, that this wouldn't have happened without him. He told the people to come. He told them that if they didn't fight, they wouldn't have a country anymore. And I heard one of the protesters in his testimony, one of the men that tased the police officer, said that, of course, he was our commander-in-chief. He told us to come, and if we didn't fight, we wouldn't have a country anymore. So he's responsible, and to trace it to the White House, you only have to trace it to what the man said himself. I mean, that's, you know, in the public domain, what he said.
Willem, thanks for the call. David, what do you think about what Willem says about efforts to say that President Trump is accountable for the people who broke into the Capitol?
Well, that's exactly what the commission is trying to, or the committees are trying to figure out at this point, is whether it is from a legal perspective, or let us say from, let's say, a more political or maybe we're saying an ethical perspective. Those are the dots they're trying to connect. And I know the listener has made some pretty good suggestions here. But again, let us just say for the sake of argument that what we have to do is to get the investigation completed, have people show up and testify so that we can figure out, again, to use the line I used before, what did the president know and when did he know it? What did he say? And was he involved at all in terms of instigating a lot of this stuff?
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. George joins us next in Dane County. George, hi.
Yeah, my question would be, seeing how executive privilege does not hold up for Trump, then all the records should be turned over. My question is, how come they're not?
George, thanks for the call. And David, this is a live legal issue, I think, with the next stop possibly at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, you're correct. At this point, the Trump administration, or let me put this, the Trump and his associates are fighting the turning over these records to Congress, claiming executive privilege. So far, they have lost in the lower courts. It is possible that this case goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve it. So I think the simple answer at this point is that we're in the middle of ongoing litigation that we assume is going to soon resolve that question regarding does and when he has to turn over those records, if at all.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. George, before we go back to our callers, David, I wanted to ask you about one legal claim that was in this PowerPoint circulated to Mark Meadows that came out of all this, and the memo written by lawyer John Eastman, who later disavowed it. But the central claim is that the vice president of the United States has, in effect, unilateral power to say yes to this batch of electors and no to this batch. Is there a legal grounds to make that claim that the vice president can do that?
There really isn't at this point. There's nothing in the text of the Constitution or in the history of the Constitution or any of the laws that suggests that the vice president really has that authority to do any of that whatsoever. At best, the counting of the electoral votes by Congress is supposed to be ceremonial, that if in fact states have followed their procedures for awarding the electoral votes and have done all that, all Congress is supposed to do is determine what has somebody gotten to the requisite 270. If they have, that's it. If they have not gotten to that, then they move on to now selecting the president of the United States themselves. But nothing, absolutely nothing, suggests that the vice president has any authority whatsoever in terms of being able to reject any votes himself or basically overturn the election.
Let's go back to our callers now. Derek is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Derek.
Hi there. Thanks so much for putting on this program. My name's Derek, and I'm a U.S. history teacher, and I've just recently taught about the peaceful revolution with the election of 1800. And some of my students frequently bring up the insurrection, and they've had an interesting question. Has there been other times in U.S. history where this transfer of power didn't go according to the plan or not peaceful?
Other hitches in the transfer of power, Derek. Thanks for the call. There was the Hayes-Tilden election took a long time, but it all stayed peaceful. Any other examples you might point a history teacher to?
Probably the only one I could point to is what? 1861, the election of Abraham Lincoln, and then the start of the Civil War. Mm. That would be my best example. If you're going to say that, what, 13 states, whatever, I forgot how many it was now, the number of states secede from the Union and a Civil War ensues, I would say that's a breakdown in the peaceful transition of power. Yet Lincoln is still president, but look at what happened. So that would be the best example that I would throw out there.
Derek, thanks a lot for the call. Best to your class. Gary joins us next in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Question I have is, I understand there are emails from Meadows to some of the organizers of the protest stating that he was going to get the National Guard to protect the protesters. I'm wondering if the professor is aware of that. And number two, it's my understanding that unless an act of war has been decreed, the governors of the states control the National Guard, not the president.
Gary, thanks for the call. That is another piece of this tranche of documents from Mark Meadows raising the thought of bringing the National Guard to protect the pro-Trump protesters, David.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. I'm not sure how I comment on that. You know, that seems to be the case in terms of bringing them in here. In terms of the president being able to bring in the National Guard, there are some situations where presidents can basically commandeer National Guard, for defense purposes, and under what the National Insurrection Act, which goes back to the early 19th century, I'm forgetting the exact date. There are some situations where presidents can also basically bring out the military for the purposes of policing and for basically keeping order. So So there are some situations where that could occur. And I'm, and as I've looked at some of the Mark Meadows stuff that's out there, I think those are the legal hooks that that they were trying to invoke in terms of trying to basically, if it looks like it was, trying to get the National Guard to protect the protesters.
Gary, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Albert is on the line in Illinois. Albert, hi.
Hello. My question is, two questions. The first would be, when Trump won the election, there were riots then, but nothing was ever done about it. And then why are the Democrats so afraid of this January 6th so-called insurrection? I'll take it offline.
Albert, thanks for the call. There were protests after President Trump won. I don't remember riots specifically related to that. But David, I think, his main question, why would Democrats find the January 6th events frightening?
Well, I'm thinking that what? If we're just talking about the events on January 6th in terms of the protesters, I don't know. I would hope most of us would be upset by the fact that what? There was a storming of the Capitol, a threatening of the lives of individuals who work in Congress, and an effort to disrupt what? A counting of the electoral votes. I would hope that everybody, Democrat, Republican, Independent, would be equally shocked by the fact that what? This is an effort to what? Basically compromise rule of law. And it's not a, that's not a peaceful protest at this point. This is what? This is really what? As we saw, a violent demonstration. I think that is a good reason for anybody to be concerned.
Albert, thanks for calling in. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you to all the listeners.
David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us today to talk about the latest from the House committee investigating the January 6th attacks at the U.S. Capitol and the events that led up to them.